Welcome, everyone, to the KNKX Studios. I'm Abe Beeson. This exclusive performance is going to be short but very sweet. Trumpeter Chris Bode is here, the worldwide star from Portland, Oregon, originally. He's topped charts and won awards across genres for decades. He's worked with Frank Sinatra, Paul Simon, Joni Mitchell, Michael Brecker, and too many others to mention here. His debut for the Blue Note label, Volume 1, came out a little over a year ago. You can catch him at Dimitri's Jazz Alley tonight through Sunday with a great band, including vocalist Veronica Swift. In the KNKX studios today, he's joined by a good friend of ours from Portland, pianist George Colligan. As a special treat for our interview today, we'll feature questions from a group of musicians from the Jazz band at Bellarmine Prep in Tacoma. Really looking forward to that. But first, let's hear some music. Please give a big KNKX welcome to Chris Bode. Fantastic, Chris Bode. Thank you so much. Thank you, George Colligan. My name's Abe Beeson, and my interview has been prepared by five students from Bellarmine Prep's Jazz Band. I'm very excited to pass the love along, and some great questions from these kids. I'm excited to get your answers to these. We'll begin with pianist Xavier Colon.
What drew you to the trumpet, and what keeps you passionate about it today?
Originally, I think it says a lot about the power of television in any generation. Sports, Michael Jordan, you turn it on, you go, oh, I want to do that. When I was a kid, there was a very famous gentleman by the name of Johnny Carson that had a show called The Tonight Show. And his band leader was the very charismatic, incredible trumpeter, Doc Severinsen. And I started trumpet when I was a little younger because I turned on the television, saw Doc Severinsen. I was in third grade, and I said, I want to do that. I didn't know anything else. My mom's like, well, you want to do what? I want to play that. And so my mom got me a cornet, and I started practice. And then later, a few years later, my band director played me some Miles Davis. That's when it clicked in to me emotionally. Because then, you know, like you start out somehow, and you just think like, oh, okay, well, can I get proficient on the instrument? And then when it hits you emotionally, then you, maybe I was 10 or 12 or something like that, then you have to realize you have to spend the next 6 years convincing your parents that you want to be a musician. Because every mom and dad is convinced their son or daughter is Paul McCartney reincarnate until they walk out and say, Mom and Dad, I'm moving to New York to be a jazz musician. Then they're like, no, you're going to be a doctor. And so you have to be pretty headstrong and convince your parents. And I think that discipline and that quest to always play, it drives me today to a large extent, keeps me super, super motivated. And it's not lost on me that when I was 7 and picked up the cornet, I didn't think about doing all this or playing on stage or touring like that. And it happened. And I feel incredibly grateful for that. And so I just, you know, knock wood, hopefully can do it for many more years.
Our next question comes from drummer Brandon Small.
Are there any specific artists or albums that inspire you to play jazz?
Ooh, interesting. Artists or albums?
Well, certainly Miles Davis and everyone that went through his band. And, you know, he has so many great records. My favorite period of his was probably like 59 to 67, and the way he kind of like devolved that. But, I mean, when it comes to trumpet players, I love all the classics. Freddie Hubbard, Clifford Brown, Wynton, Miles, of course, Woody Shaw, who I got to study with. And so I like all the traditional meat and potatoes. You know, it's different because you're a popular musician, artist, correct? Or are you a jazz pop? Okay. So that landscape is changing so much. And whereas jazz musicians, it would be like asking a young pop person what they like, and they're like, I don't know, I just like Led Zeppelin and the Beatles, right? The jazz musicians, like if you look at the scope, if you're going to like play the saxophone, you're going to go to Joe Henderson, John Coltrane, and Michael Brecker. Sonny Rollins. I mean, you know, you're talking about, it's not like somebody today. Yes, there are a couple of great ones, but the meat and potatoes, it's like the big boom happened, you know, in the 50s and the 60s, and those are how you learn the language on the highest level, which is different than pop music today. You could say, I love Coldplay, or I love blah, blah, blah. You know, like, I like all the traditional stuff that everyone already knows and likes.
Our next question comes from a trumpet player and trombonist and French horn, too. He's Mr. Brass over here, Micaiah Tinkler.
I just wanted to ask, how do you balance technical proficiency with emotional expression?
I don't think you can plan for that. I think you just... It's kind of a music career or something like, it's like a you know, the yellow brick road where you just one step here. So you know, I remember the first time I was able to scratch up enough money to pay my rent in New York, I thought I'd won an Academy Award. You know, you just feel like, oh my God, I can pay the landlord and I'm not out on the streets, whatever. And then you manipulate it and go, okay, could I maybe stand in front of an audience and then like, wait, can I move emotions? And all that takes, you know, it's like a paper cuts, you know, like it's a very small little step. And then all of a sudden you're like, wait, hold on. Okay, this is kind of working. You can't just set out one day and go, I want to play proficient on my instrument and emotional. I think you got to like try out how you relate emotionally to an audience for that thing. Technically proficient in a practice room, you can do guns a-blazing in high school or college or whatever. You can work on that stuff in the privacy of a practice room. But when you go out in front, if you're trying to move someone's emotion, it has to be like you're playing in front of people and you're going, okay, that is something I want to get out, and that's getting over. Jazz musicians, there's a fair amount of them that are cursed by, they have unlimited chops and technique, so they just go out there and they just motor through all those chops and technique, and that gives it a very academic sound, but not necessarily an emotional one, which is cool, you know, like and that's fine. But I think that it's a little bit more, I mean, there's a very famous Bill Evans quote where he said, Miles Davis, he made his best music in his 40s when he was in his 40s and 50s because he was mature, and not only were the corners of his, maybe you look at Miles playing when he was 50, how much more strong he was compared to the way he was when he played with Charlie Parker. Like his corners are falling in, he's playing on cup mute and not really dealing. Later, he matured into this like strong player, and then all of a sudden he had this depth of emotion that just came in really in focus later in his life. You know, I don't know if the prodigy thing is as great for jazz as everyone wants it to be. If you're 15 and a great saxophonist, doesn't mean you're going to be 25 and a great saxophonist. Like, I want people to mature and not take advantage of their teenage years for something other than that. Anyhow.
Good answer. Our next question comes from bassist Joey Masterson.
How do you prepare for a live show, and how does it differ from playing in a recording?
Well, to give you an example, tonight we're going to take the stage, and this will be our... we had one travel day to San Francisco where we didn't play, but this will be our 56th night in a row. So I left California on Thanksgiving night, and we haven't had a night off since. Majority of my time is touring and is playing live. Now, in the 80s and the 90s, I was a studio musician in New York. So I got to see, you know, the best producers make pop records, make jazz records, make big band. Like, I got to see, there's a real skill set to playing in the studio. And again, I'll say this, it relates to the last question about the, you know, academia and stuff like that. A lot of jazz musicians think if they're lighting it up at a club at 2 o'clock in the morning where everyone's intoxicated and they're like, yeah, this is great, we're going to reduplicate that in the studio, they've got another thing coming. If you look at back to Miles Davis, his most famous record, Kind of Blue, it was like as much to do with the production and the microphones and the depth perception. That's in the studio. And that record probably shows more restraint than Miles ever had. You know, he released a bunch of other stuff, Miles Smiles or Live at the Plug Nickel and stuff like that. Those are for the enthusiast, hardcore jazz musicians. But the general public wants to hear Kind of Blue, right? And that's a dreamy record, and it's more lyrical than anything Miles ever did. And, you know, the pianos, Bill Evans is sitting back here with, like, the best reverb on it. It's got, they recorded it at the Sony Studios in New York, and they really had the best of the best. So there is an art form to learning how to play in the studio. And then if you're going to take your art form in front of an audience, there's an art form to being on the road too. And there's also an art form to being on the road. You can't tell you how many jazz musicians or pop musicians. I've been in Sting's band and Joni's band and Paul Simon's band, done all these long tours, and how many musicians aren't prepared for a life of touring. They want to be at home with their dog, their cat, their girlfriend, whatever, husband, blah, blah, blah. And I love touring. And also, you have a responsibility. You can't be, I remember the first day I was in Sting's band, I came down, they said, what time's lobby call? Okay, 3 o'clock. I came down at 3 o'clock, they're already gone. And I was like, wait, what? But I'm not here at 3 o'clock. No, dude, 3 o'clock means 2:50. Minute Sting gets down, he doesn't wait for anyone. Boom, out. Gone. He's never late, and he's gone early, you know? And so I was like, oh, but then now you see, like, you know, you get some lobby calls. We don't have that anymore in our band, but you know, like, people come down 20 minutes late and stuff like that. Okay. You're looking for a day crescendo of your career. So there's the personal habits. There's the personal habits. There's how often do you want to tour? We're madmen. I tour 250 days a year. And, but a lot of people don't want to do that. and they want more seclusion and all that stuff. I just love it all, that whole world of touring and being on the road and stuff like that. But it's an acquired taste, trust me.
Great question next from saxophonist Kent Hoyden.
Yeah, could you describe a challenge in your career and how you overcame that?
I mean, I think there's challenges with every kind of step that you make in music, well, in anything. But I mean, in the 90s, the challenge was there was a radio format and, you know, you had to break onto this radio format and then they pigeonholed you and you spent a lot of your time, you know, navigating record company politics or radio politics. And then that sort of went away. And now the challenge, you know, is quite different. Like now the challenge is like, how can I stay fit and on top of my game trumpet playing wise? So, because the trumpet's an unforgiving mistress, right? It doesn't care how many hours you've been flying or whatever your mental state is or whatever, like it'll just come back at you and bite you. So you have to like stay on it so you have elasticity in your playing, which is completely, when you're trying to make it, you're like frustrated because you can't get on the radio and some radio promotion person thinks your music is too melancholy, so they're not gonna put it on the radio and you're like, oh God. And so then, but that changes and every 4 or 5 years, there's a different challenge and you just try to face it like you did when you tried to pay your landlord. You know, it's that small, you know, step. You try to like keep it, you know, not rather than a broad thing like the whole world, blah, blah, blah. You keep it to the, you know, the more smaller scope of what the problem is and try to deal with that.
Our freshman pianist, Xavier, has a question I think is a nice follow-up to that.
Could you describe a moment or a turning point that shaped your journey as a musician?
So 1999, I was playing this film soundtrack in London, and I guess I should back up and say, in 1996, I was in a yoga class, and you come out of the yoga class, and your endorphins are like, ta-da, like, and you think you can conquer the world, and someone said, Frank Sinatra had just passed away, and I was like, oh. So I was, my first professional gig when I was a kid, I dropped out of college, which is not a good bit of advice, but I got a gig with Sinatra. And I thought my mom loves Sinatra so much that she would probably let me leave college if I was going on the road with Sinatra. And it's true. So I went right from the yoga class home, and I had done a couple of little duets with Sting along the way. And I just called his assistant, and I said, I know this is weird, but I'm doing a new record, and I played in Frank Sinatra's band. I always wanted to do this song in the wee small hours of the morning. Do you think Sting would want to sing it? You know, click. I didn't think, you know, heck no. And the next day she called back and he said, yeah, Sting would love to do it as long as you fly to Italy to his castle and play on his record. I'm like, oh, who got the better end of that deal? and then so we became a little friendly-ish. And in 1999, we went to the Dorchester Hotel in London for drinks. And he said, I want you to, like, bow out of your career for 2 or 3 years and join my band. And he goes, and I promise you I'll break the sound of your trumpet to the whole world, and most of those people will not be jazz fans, but they'll become Chris Botti fans. And I was like, okay. And so since 1999, he made me that offer. So many things have flown, you know, through his scope. Like, for instance, I became his opening act, and someone in the audience was like, oh, my friend Oprah Winfrey would love this guy. And the next week we were on Oprah Winfrey, and I went from like completely unknown to like top of the pop chart. It was like bizarre, surreal, right? But this all happened because Sting said, I want that guy and I'll break it. So.
And kind of a nice follow-up on that. We've talked about your many collaborations. You just mentioned Sting and of course Sinatra and Joni Mitchell and Paul Simon and on and on. We've got 3 questions about those collaborations. Let's start with our drummer, Brandon.
So what did you take away from those many collaborations?
I when I played in Joni Mitchell's band, it was interesting. Like she really read me the riot act one afternoon. I mean, she's can be quite the taskmaster, and I just have so much respect for her. She's so awesome. But she was like, Chris, don't knock me out of the batter's box. And I realized that a lot of jazz musicians, when they're playing with singers, you dip in and you let the sound of your horn over. You don't get up in it with your content too much. So if I'm working with Streisand or Bocelli or something like that, it's a more of like an audio kind of conversation back and forth. That really helped me a ton and how to work with pop singers. And I'll get back to it. A lot of jazz musicians don't want to work with popular singers. They want to go off and play bebop or avant-garde stuff or electronica music or, you know, whatever. Jam band stuff, cool. And I, my way in, because my first gig was, my first real popular gig was that band with Mike Brecker and Steve Gadd and playing in Paul Simon's world tour. And I got to see how he crafted and how he really made popular music accessible. And I have such affection for that working with those, whether it's John Mayer or Buble or whatever. Like, I like it. And then I learned kind of how to, like, relate to singers, because it's a different thing. You know, like, you know, when I played with Streisand all a bunch of times, you know, like, she likes the space, you know, so it's, you know, you don't want to just, like, play the Bridge of Cherokee in her face, because she, like, she'll be like, wait, what? You know, so.
Our next question, back to bassist Joey Masterson.
How has collaborations in different genres influenced your music?
Oh, it has probably my most successful album ever was one I did in Boston, and that concert was Chris Botti in Boston. It was Steven Tyler, Sting, Yo-Yo Ma, Josh Groban, who else? I can't remember who else. John Mayer, did I say that? Yeah, anyhow, so but in a bunch of, like, collaborations. And since then, collaborating with Bocelli or on and on, Buble, and I can't tell you how many people, like, what new artists would you want to collaborate with? Young artists. And I was like, hold on a second. When I did that show live in Boston, all of those people were my friends first. I knew them socially. Like, I called up Steven Tyler. I said, do you want to do this? He's like, yeah, man, let's do it. You know, so I knew them socially first. Like, now if I wanted to collaborate with Ariana Grande or whatever, like, I respect her, but it would seem like commerce, because it would be put together by a record company. So first and foremost, I recognize that all those collaborations, David Foster is the person that hooked me up with Bocelli. And now Andrea and I are friends, but we've done tons of stuff together. But originally it came through David Foster, who's a famous producer and one of my closest friends. And he's the guy that made that swim out. And so now I think that the collaborations is such a huge part of my record, because I've had people guest on all my albums as singers. But I also recognize that, you know, it wouldn't be honest for me to go like, oh, I just want to do like the latest rap star or whatever. Like, I don't know, sparingly.
And kind of a nice follow-up to that from our saxophonist, Kent.
Who'd you love to collaborate that you haven't yet, living or past?
Beethoven? No, I'm kidding. I mean, on that list, I've just been able to, like, play with everyone. I don't know who I would be. I would have loved to have done something with Sinatra that was on a record, you know, like where we actually played in the style that I play now and have him sing. You know, that would have been awesome. Yeah, it's hard for me to answer that question, because I've been so fortunate to do all those collaborations with those singers and stuff like that. So I don't know.
Well, let's bring it right back into the room. Tell us about your collaboration with a favorite musician of ours, George Colligan.
Well, I mean, arguably, it's only 20 hours old. Well, we met 2 years ago, and he played one show with us 2.5 years ago, right? Yeah. And then last night was his first night really in my band, us playing here in Seattle, and just monster talent. Just so great. Hopefully many more.
And one more from our students. Micaiah has our last question.
I'm sure it's not the first time you've heard this question, but do you have any advice for young musicians interested in a career in the arts?
The most important thing is consistency. It's consistency of your point of view, your, like, getting back to, like, the parent thing. It's you have to, like, convince not only yourself to go into a practice room and dedicate yourself, not on a Monday and Tuesday, but every day for hours and hours and hours. And then you have to convince the people around you that love and care for you, that you will make it in your own best interest, whatever that is. You might say, I'm going to be a French hornist and then become a record publicist or producer or something like that. But, I mean, back to the baby steps, you just can't get whatever advice I give you. It's got to be an internal dialogue, and it has to lead to consistency of practice. And then from that, you have to be passionate about what you say to the people that maybe don't want you to be in harm's way. They don't want you to be like in your eighth year of college with a debt mounting and then not have a plan. But that's okay if you're very passionate about that. You know, it's the people that kind of like meander a bit that just get scooped away. And they practice a little bit, and I had one gig. You got to have passion about for yourself and what you say, and then you have to let it flow. And you got to navigate, but you have to internally be dedicated. The drive, you know, is 99% of success. Drive, not talent, because drive will keep you in a practice room, and you can get that. You can acquire the talent, but drive is the defining factor to everyone.
Great answer, and I'll feed you one more, Chris, before we let you go for the day. We were so excited at the radio station when the Blue Note album came out. Volume 1 kind of suggests there will be a Volume 2. Tell us, first of all, about joining the Blue Note label and what's next.
Well, it's an honor to be part of that rich history of music. And I did Volume 1, and yeah, there'll be Volume 2, and hopefully we're going to record it maybe in the fall this year. That seems to be kind of the thought process, but... You know, the record industry is forever shifting around. And so I, you know, again, it's like to his question there, like I'm kind of like, whoop, okay, let's, you know. So, but I'm very honored to be associated with them. And Don Was is awesome that runs the label there. And they're all fantastic.
Thank you so much, Chris Bode, for being here. Let's hear it for him. And George Colligan on piano. Thanks also to our School of Jazz kids from Bellarmine Prep in Tacoma. Check out their studio session performance on our School of Jazz page at knkx.org. Big thanks to our sponsors at the University of Washington Professional and Continuing Education Program. Thanks to our KNKX Studio Sessions team, audio engineer Brian Moynihan, video producer Parker Blome, promotions director Brenda Goldstein-Young. This KNKX Studio Session is presented in partnership with Jazz Alley. I'm Abe Beeson. Thanks for listening.